Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Friday, May 5th, 2006. I'm Jake Wallner.
I'm Becca Bartleson.
Coming up on the KBOO Morning News, a redevelopment project for Portland's Urban Renewal Agency does not have to pay minimum wages to construction workers. The United States is due to appear before the United Nations Committee on Torture. And United States, Britain, and France press for sanctions against Iran if it refuses to halt uranium enrichment. Today's Portland area weather, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s. Tonight, partly cloudy in the evening, then mostly cloudy, lows 45 to 50.
Signature gathering begins today for an initiative petition raising cigarette taxes 60 cents per pack to provide universal health care for Oregon children. The measure, sponsored by Republican Representative Billy Dalto and three other lawmakers, would expand health care to all Oregonians younger than 19 and extend coverage for low-income adults. It would also pay for more campaigns against smoking. The State Elections Division cleared the deck for signature gathering Tuesday after a legal tussle ended about how the measure will be worded if it makes the November ballot. Oregon hospitals and insurers agreed to contribute $150,000 in a challenge grant to pay for signature gatherers. Other health care providers committed to match that amount, said Emily Katz of Care Oregon, a managed care group that serves many low-income people on the Oregon Health Plan. Dalto and other backers retooled an earlier version of the initiative to meet objections by anti-tobacco groups. Sponsors agreed to spend 7% of the proceeds on anti-tobacco programs. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
The Elections Division now has approved 29 initiative petitions for signature gathering. Proposals aimed for the November ballot include a state spending limit, a state income tax cut, the regional election of statewide judges, legislative term limits, parental notification for abortions, an open primary, and campaign finance reform.
Oregon's poultry industry is small compared with the state's largest agricultural commodities, such as nursery stock, cattle, and calves, hay, milk, and grass seed. However, the value of the 24 million fryers and 3 million egg-laying chickens in Oregon barns is significant. Wednesday's tour of a Dayton farm was set against a backdrop of growing worries about a flu pandemic. Most documented instances of humans becoming infected with avian influenza have been in people who come in close contact with live birds or contaminated surfaces, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Poultry farms routinely check for birds for avian flu. Officials promised a prompt response if the disease is detected in Oregon. Birds suspected of being exposed to the disease would be killed immediately on the farm and their remains composted on site. A 6.5-mile quarantine would be placed around the farm, restricting the movement of birds from neighboring properties. A federal program might compensate farmers for lost birds if the disease reaches the United States, but farms could be shut down for weeks. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
The Oregon Supreme Court ruled yesterday that an employer didn't break state disability laws by firing a worker who used medical marijuana. The case involves Robert Washburn, a former worker at the Columbia Forest Products plant at Klamath Falls, who was fired after failing drug tests. Washburn had a state-issued card allowing him to use marijuana to ease leg spasms that disrupted his sleep. He used the drug at home, but the company, which has a policy prohibiting workers from coming to the plant with controlled substances in their systems, fired him in 2001 after he failed several urine tests. Washburn sued the company, saying that his condition left him legally disabled, and that required the employer to make reasonable accommodations for him under the Oregonians with Disabilities Law. A circuit court decision said the state medical marijuana law doesn't require employers to accommodate the medical use of marijuana in the workplace. However, the Oregon Court of Appeals disagreed, saying the test results didn't establish that Washburn, a millwright, had used the drug at work.
A redevelopment project involving the city's Urban Renewal Agency does not have to pay state-imposed minimum wages for construction workers. The Bureau of Labor and Industries have claimed that private construction projects receiving tax money and under government control should pay so-called prevailing wages. But the Portland Development Commission contended it did not control the construction project at issue. Multnomah County Circuit Judge Henry Cantor agreed with the commission and rejected the prevailing wage claim. At stake was only $225,000 in additional wages, but developers were concerned the case would set a precedent that could boost the cost of future public-private redevelopment and affordable housing projects. The Development Commission sued the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries after the state agency said the prevailing wage must be paid for a Northeast Portland project. The commission contended the prevailing wage could increase costs by up to 30%, although the state agency said it would be less.
The animal shelter operated by the Humane Society of Tacoma and Pierce County in Washington State is filled to capacity. If the animals sheltered there aren't adopted soon, shelter workers will have to start putting many of them to death. Last year, 2,500 cats and dogs at the shelter were killed because there were no homes for them. Today, the shelter is filled to capacity. All 300 foster families have pets. This week, the Humane Society put out its euthanasia alert. Kitty Gibbs of the Tacoma Pierce County Humane Society says Pierce County has one of the worst pet overpopulation problems in Washington State, if not on the West Coast. The Tacoma shelter aims to become a no-kill shelter, but there's only so much space for stray cats and dogs. To help ease the crisis, the shelter is reducing adoption fees Saturday.
California state lawmakers approved a plan earlier today to let voters decide whether to spend a record $37 billion on roads, schools, and flood control. The bond package, which has broad public support but failed to pass the legislature, now goes to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who called it a landmark accomplishment that will yield benefits for generations to come. Voters in November will be asked to consider four propositions: $19.9 billion for roads and transit projects, $10.4 billion for school and university buildings, $4.1 billion for flood control, and $2.85 billion for affordable housing projects. Together, they make up the largest bond package in California history. Schwarzenegger has made passage of a massive public works spending plan the centerpiece of his re-election year agenda. During his State of the State address in January, the Republican governor proposed selling $68 billion in bonds to help pay for the $222.6 billion in spending over 10 years. An attempt to place a smaller bond measure on the June ballot failed in March when lawmakers and the governor could not reach a compromise. Despite the legislative setback, polls show that Schwarzenegger's proposal to upgrade the state's highways, bridges, schools, levees, and water systems had broad public support.
A disagreement between the city of Hercules, California, and the world's biggest retailer over a section of land near San Pablo Bay is heating up. The Hercules City Council will consider during its May 23rd meeting whether to use eminent domain to seize 17 acres that Walmart owns. The move comes after Walmart rejected a city offer to buy the land. Walmart bought the property in November after another developer received city approvals for a neighborhood shopping center. But in February, city planners recommended denying Walmart's proposal for a big box store on the property. The retailer has since submitted a new application, saying it conforms to city regulations.
High costs at the gas pumps and higher profits for the oil and gas industry have prompted California's Attorney General Bill Lockyer to investigate oil companies on gas gouging. States across the country are doing the same, and consumer rights groups are calling for a windfall tax to invest in alternative energy. FSRN's Christina Onestad reports.
The 21 oil refiners in California, including ExxonMobil, Shell, Valero, BP, and their CEOs, are under investigation by State Attorney General Bill Lockyer for price gouging at the gas pumps. Attorney General Bill Lockyer.
The oil company's attitude is, if it's not illegal, it's okay. Probably we can't prove illegality. They don't need to break the law to stick it to consumers. That's the nature of an oligopolistic market. But we can do some things to provide better fuel standards for automobiles, alternative energy sources. There's a lot we can do to increase competition and reduce demand.
Lockyer and nine other state attorneys general, including Oregon and New York, are also challenging the Bush administration's fuel economy standards they say haven't changed in 20 years, would preempt tougher state emission laws, and continue to increase gas prices. Meanwhile, consumer advocates are pushing for a national windfall tax on oil companies' increased profits. Tyson Slocum is director of Public Citizens Energy Program.
On average, it costs a company like ExxonMobil about $20 to extract a barrel of oil, whether that's in Nigeria or California. They're turning around and selling that for $70 a barrel. That is not illegal. It is not going to register on any of these investigations into price gouging. So the answer is to implement a windfall profits tax on these huge earnings that the oil companies are enjoying and use the proceeds of that windfall profits tax to invest in sustainable energy solutions and mass transit and energy efficiency, all the things that are going to help solve America's energy crisis.
But a windfall tax may be difficult to pass through Congress. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, this year the oil and gas industry has contributed over $7 million to congressional campaigns, with 80% of it going to Republicans. That's why the grassroots group Californians for Clean Energy is taking the issue to the people. The California group is seeking to get a windfall tax on oil refiners in the state on the November ballot. For FSRN, I'm Christina Onnested.
Six men who worked for the Big Dig's largest concrete supplier were arrested yesterday on federal charges, accusing them of falsifying records to hide the inferior quality of concrete delivered to the massive highway project. The six, all current or former employees of Aggregate Industries, face a variety of charges, including making false statements, mail fraud, and conspiracy to defraud the government between 1996 and August 2005. The indictment charges the men with recycling concrete that was too old or already rejected by inspectors, and in some cases double billing for the loads. The company was paid $105 million for 135,000 truckloads of concrete, and at least 5,000 truckloads did not meet specifications, according to the indictment. Lawyers for Aggregate Industries have defended the quality of its concrete and said it never delivered any that did not meet strength specifications called for in the state contract. Stephen Dolinsky, an attorney for one of the defendants, Gerard McNally, said prosecutors are looking to place blame for the troubled project.
Angry conservatives are driving the approval ratings of President Bush and the GOP-led Congress to dismal new lows, according to an AP poll that underscores why Republicans fear an Election Day massacre. 6 months out, the intensity of opposition to Bush and Congress has risen sharply, along with the percentage of Americans who believe the nation is on the wrong track. The AP poll also suggests that Democratic voters are far more motivated than Republicans. Elections in the middle of a president's term traditionally favor the party whose core supporters are the most energized. This week's survey of 1,000 adults, including 865 registered voters. The survey found that just 33% of the public approves of Bush's job performance, the lowest of his presidency. That compares with 36% approval in early April. 45% of self-described conservatives now disapprove of the president.
U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was repeatedly interrupted and heckled by anti-war protesters during a speech. One protester, retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, accused Mr. Rumsfeld of lying to the American people about the presence of WMD in Iraq before the war. Rumsfeld rejected the accusation and said the Bush administration based its assertions on existing intelligence. The outbursts were more severe than the previous protests Mr. Rumsfeld has faced over the Iraq War, correspondents say. It comes weeks after Mr. Rumsfeld was called upon to resign by six retired senior U.S. military officers for his handling of the war. The defense secretary was giving a speech on military alliances in Atlanta, Georgia, when he was interrupted by hecklers, including one who carried a sign saying, "Guilty of war crimes." Three protesters were escorted away by security, while a fourth stood in the middle of the room with his back to Mr. Rumsfeld in silent protest, the Associated Press reports.
The U.S. is due to appear before the U.N. Committee on Torture for the first time since launching its war on terror after the September 11, 2001 attacks. 30 senior officials from the Departments of State, Defense, Justice, and Homeland Security will testify in the public at the hearing in Geneva. They are likely to face tough questions about practices used in the anti-terror drive, correspondents say. Rights groups accuse the U.S. of flouting the U.N. Convention Against Torture. They accuse the U.S. of allowing the torture and inhumane treatment of foreign terror suspects at their detention centers in Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo Bay, and elsewhere. This is the first time since 2000 that the U.S. has testified publicly before the committee, which, as a signatory to the U.N. Convention Against Torture, it is required to do. 10 legal experts will cross-examine the U.S. team, led by State Department legal advisor John Bellinger, in public hearings that are due to continue until Monday. This from the BBC.
two of three rebel groups battling the Sudanese government for control of the country's Darfur region resisted intense international pressure today to sign an accord aimed at ending a conflict that has claimed at least 180,000 lives. In New York, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan urged all countries to press the warring parties to reach agreement, but warned the international community has an obligation to protect civilians in Darfur by force if need be. Abdelwahid Mohamed El-Nour of the main rebel Sudan Liberation Army walked out of the negotiations before dawn Friday, saying, "We are not going to sign." The action came shortly after a similar declaration from the Small Justice and Equality Movement, while a splinter rebel faction said it needed time to consult with colleagues in Sudan. The decision came after days of negotiations that culminated in an all-night session with the African Union, rebels and envoys from the United States, Britain, the European Union, and the Arab League. Deadlines have been extended twice since Sunday, and Thursday's session went 5 hours beyond the midnight timeline limit.
Zapatistas have declared a red alert, closing Caracoles and autonomous municipalities in the state of Chiapas. The move after the violent eviction of workers and farmers trying to sell flowers in a market near Mexico City, where Walmart is attempting to build another superstore. The police action left two dead and at least 48 people injured. Social groups, student and indigenous organizations are shutting down highways and occupying schools today. Demonstration at Mexican consulates in New York and Los Angeles are scheduled to begin today, denouncing the federal police's actions. Mass mobilizations are already occurring throughout Mexico City, where Subcommandant Marcos is participating in pacifist political actions. FSRN's Vladimir Flores reports.
Thousands of police took the town of San Salvador Atenco by force this morning, searching from house to house for members of the People's Front in defense of the land. A violent confrontation yesterday between townspeople and police left a 14-year-old boy dead and dozens seriously injured. Over 200 townspeople have since been taken into police custody. During a rally in Mexico City yesterday, Zapatista Subcomandante Marcos declared a red alert in Zapatista rebel territory and called for mobilizations.
No sabemos ustedes, pero los zapatistas somos hoy.
We don't know about you all, but we Zapatistas today are Atenco. The troops of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation have already been put on red alert. We are asking for actions and mobilizations to be planned and carried out throughout the country in support of the People's Front in defense of the land.
Frente de pueblos en defensa de la tierra.
As part of the nationwide tour known as the Other Campaign, the Zapatista caravan stayed in San Salvador Atenco just last week. The town made international headlines in the summer of 2002 when a popular uprising prevented the expropriation of communal land for the construction of a new international airport for Mexico City. Atenco resident America del Valle participated in that uprising and now has an arrest warrant over her head.
It's a provocation that isn't just related to the other campaign, because they know perfectly well that once the other campaign has passed through our towns, the movement in the region is strengthened. On the other hand, they are carrying out a standing vendetta ever since we were able to stop the federal government's plan for its rotten airport.
President Vicente Fox today said the campesinos' actions represent a threat for Mexican society. A massive police operation is in effect throughout the Mexican capital today, but that hasn't stopped hundreds of people from blocading the city's major roads. Ashantil, a university student, spoke to FSRM from a blockade in the western part of the city this morning.
There are around 500 of us here, indigenous people and women. We are gathered here because there's a call out that if there are confrontations, we keep it calm.
The blockade of Mexico City's major highways continue at airtime, and further actions and demonstrations have been announced for later today. For FSRN, I am Vladimir Flores reporting.
The leaders of Argentina and Brazil have accepted Bolivia's nationalization of its gas industry, but want talks on future prices and foreign involvement. The deal was reached at an energy summit, which also included Venezuela. Earlier this week, President Evo Morales took control of Bolivia's natural gas industry and told foreign firms to leave if they did not comply. Brazil and Argentina rely on cheap gas imports from Bolivia and fear that nationalization could push prices up. Venezuela has South America's largest reserves of oil and gas, and it has pledged to help Bolivia in the nationalization of its own energy industry. The Bolivian government said it will start renegotiating energy contracts with all foreign companies from next week, giving them 180 days to reach an agreement or face eviction. They will be asked to hand over majority control of all Bolivian operations to the country's state oil firm, Yacimientos Petrolíferos Fiscales Bolivianos. State-owned Brazilian energy firm Petrobras, the largest foreign investor in Bolivian energy, has said it would cancel further investments. But President Lula said this decision could be reversed after more negotiations. This from the BBC.
Venezuela is ready to drive back any threat or aggression, reiterated General Raul Isaias Badul, the commander of the Venezuelan army, in reference to U.S. military maneuvers in the Caribbean. Badul said the National Armed Forces, FAN, is assessing the possible dangers that are currently hovering over the country's security. General Badul pointed out that FAN is monitoring all activities that might indicate some sort of threat against the national territory and have assessed four possible scenarios against Venezuelan security. The first is so-called asymmetric war, when one of the belligerents has a sizable military advantage and the other resorts to avoiding direct engagement. The second scenario is destabilization and disruption, for example, by the use of coups or subversion actions. A third is the way, by the way, of a regional conflict, whereby international players would be manipulated to declare Venezuela as a threat state, thus providing a reason for an invasion. A fourth scenario would be military intervention like that taking place against Iraq. This from the Dow Jones News Service.
The United States, Britain, and France are pushing for sanctions if Iran continues to defy demands that it halt uranium enrichment, but not the sweeping economic and military embargoes imposed on Iraq after its 1990 invasion of Kuwait. What the UN Security Council's three veto-wielding Western members aim for are targeted sanctions, such as restricting trade in equipment with both civilian and military uses, and banning travel and freezing the assets of Iranians who oversee the country's nuclear program. UN sanctions imposed on Saddam Hussein's regime banned all Iraqi imports and exports except food and medicine, and authorized inspections of shipments in and out of Iraq to verify their cargo. The sanctions halted legal oil exports from Iraq, a major producer with the world's second largest reserves. Bolton said targeted sanctions would also likely include restricting trade in dual use and other sensitive items. Bolton said that while it would be desirable to have a unanimous Security Council when an Iran resolution under Chapter 7 was adopted, it's not impossible that we would proceed without it. In Paris, U.S. Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns predicted that Europe would agree to support a Security Council resolution that would carry the unstated threat of sanctions.
The smooth blacktop roads and 24-hour electricity of Herat set this Afghan commercial capital apart as a model of stability in a country still struggling to get on its feet. Much of the wealth in this western city, with its tree-lined streets and handsome shops, is credited to the largesse of Iran. The Shiite Republic, one of Afghanistan's greatest trading partners, has a visible hand here, building roads and schools and keeping shops afloat with electricity and goods. What's more, these projects represent only a fraction of the $204 million Iran has spent in aid, ranking it among the top donors to post-conflict Afghanistan. Even though the U.S. and Iran are locked in an international struggle over Iran's alleged pursuit of nuclear weapons, the longtime foes have worked together well in Afghanistan, a place where they have common ground. Pushing Iran against the wall through sanctions or war could deal a setback to the recovery here, the first battlefield in the war on terror, some observers say. Iranian influence is certainly nothing new in Afghanistan. The two countries share centuries of history, thousands of miles of porous borders, and a common language. Nearly 2,000 people commute across the border every day. This from the Christian Science Monitor.
Hamas could reciprocate moves toward peace if Israel agrees to withdraw from all lands occupied in 1967 and recognizes Palestinian rights, according to Haaretz. Meshal told a packed auditorium at Damascus University, however, that he did not think Israel would be likely to make such commitments in the foreseeable future, leaving the Palestinians no option but to continue to resist occupation. The Muslim group won Palestinian general elections in January and formed its first government in March. The group has since been under increasing Western and Israeli pressure to recognize Israel, abandon armed struggle, and accept interim peace deals signed by the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Moussaoui Abu Marzouk, deputy head of Hamas political bureau, said that his group would not obstruct attempts to revive an initiative endorsed by Arab leaders at a 2002 Beirut summit, though he said such initiatives were doomed to fail.
The new Palestinian prime minister has charged the U.S. with blocking money to pay 165,000 of its public sector workers. Ismail Haniyeh told a news conference that the Hamas-led government had raised money, but so far has not found a way to get into the Palestinian areas. Haniyeh appealed to Arab leaders to face up to the Americans to stop the siege imposed on the Palestinian people and to stop the political blackmail against the government. He also called on Palestinian bankers to show the necessary patriotism. Banks have been hesitant to handle funds for the Palestinian Authority for fear of U.S. sanctions. At his news conference, Haniyeh also spoke out against a plan by Ehud Olmert, the incoming Israeli prime minister, to draw the border between Israel and the West Bank unilaterally if peace talks are unsuccessful. By completing a separation barrier, relocating tens of thousands of Jewish settlers, and pulling out of large parts of the West Bank. This from Al Jazeera.
Thousands of residents have fled East Timor's capital, Dili, fearing new clashes between ex-soldiers and police. Roads around the city are reported to be packed with vehicles containing household valuables as people head to the nearby mountains. At least four people were killed and dozens hurt in last week's clashes. The violence erupted during a rally following the sacking of some 600 soldiers for going on strike in March to demand better working conditions. This from the BBC.
Tony Blair has suffered a poor night in England's local elections as Labour lost 251 councillors. The main gainers were the Tories, who had their best results since 1992. The Liberal Democrats failed to make much headway. Elsewhere, the British National Party doubled its councillors, including winning 11 seats off Labour and Barking. The Greens also made gains. The Prime Minister will reshuffle his cabinet today as he seeks to regain momentum after days of bad headlines. Heavy losses for Labour are likely to trigger further calls for Tony Blair to name the day for him to leave his position. More than one in three people want Blair to go now, according to an ICM poll for the BBC. Of the 1,002 people questioned in the telephone survey, 36% Mr. Blair should go now. Another 14% wanted him to resign before the end of 2006. That was the KBOO Morning News for Friday, May 5th, 2006. Portland area weather today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s. Tonight, partly cloudy and 45 to 50. Saturday, mostly cloudy, cooler, highs around 65. Saturday night, mostly cloudy with a slight chance of showers, lows around 45. And Sunday, showers likely, highs around 60, lows 40 to 45. Thanks for joining us for this morning's news. This morning's newscast was edited by Becca Bartleson and Chris Andre. Our engineer and the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenstein. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Jake.
Ballner.